Hey, folks. If you're a podcast listener and not somebody that joins us in community in person, then you should be aware we've got a couple of weeks in a row here where we're still sorting out a technical problem with recording the Talkie Bits live. And so there's a couple of re-records here, but the content is there. And I wanted to put them up anyway, just so if you're tracking along with an idea or this is a podcast that you regularly visit, you don't suddenly hit a big stretch of blank spots. But if they feel a little bit different, sound a little bit different for a couple of weeks, just because we're getting it sorted on the live end. And in the meantime, I'm re-recording these based on the things that I had written down to guide me in the morning itself. In this particular morning, I wanted to explore the idea, the question, where do you hang your hat? And it's here in Winnipeg, it's going to be hat season soon. Maybe it already is, depending how tender your ears are. I'm sorry if that feels like bad news if you're a Winnipegger. Some of us find it helpful when we come to this season to think of it as more like sweater season instead, because that's a happier fashion thought. We can think, you know, instead of having to feel like, oh man, a toque, bad hair days coming up, we can think, that sweater, you know, that fantastic cozy garment that's been hanging in my closet languishing all summer. I get to wear that, and that can kind of feel nice after the heat of summer. But the times, as the great poet Bob Dylan said, the times, they are a-changing. And when you look outside and there's early season snow on the ground, you know, at the beginning of October, you can feel that they're changing. In my personal world, I can tell that the times they are changing because there are less and less kids in our house these days. I think I'm feeling that especially this year because Tyrion, our second youngest, has started his last year of high school. And as a homeschool family that's already launched two adult kids, I know that that means he'll be around less and less. And that's okay. I really like Tyrion. I like having him around, but we didn't raise him or any of our kids to stick around indefinitely, so this movement toward a more independent life is what we expect, is what we hope for. But still, there's this significant kind of empty spot in a household when someone that's been there their entire life isn't there so much anymore. It you feel it. And because Corrine and I have four kids, and because we like to play outside, we wear a lot of hats. That is not a metaphor. Our household owns a ridiculous amount of hats. And that means that we need lots of places to put hats, especially when they're wet from rain or snow or, you know, ick, sweat. So when we moved into the house we live in now, we had this idea for a hat rack that would accommodate our, you know, our hat obsession. Let's say our hat necessity. That feels way better. So my dad, who used to say it was a construction company, we can make anything with wood, kind of took this concept and fabricated this fantastic hat rack for us. Now, when I talked about this at the table, I had a photograph of this particular hat rack that I put up. And there was kind of this collective, ooh, from the community, because although I'd never counted them before I was preparing to talk about this and I took the photograph, there are 50 wooden pegs, 50 wooden pegs on this rack, 50 places where you could hang your hat. That's a lot of places to hang your hat. Anyway, that one's downstairs in the basement entry where, you know, all the hats and boots and mitts tend to hang out more often. But by our front entry, Dad also made us this awesome custom coat rack that some of you have, you know, tossed your coats on over the years. But it just had these kind of three big arms on the top. And because it's just inside the door, you can come in and you just throw your jacket on it. It's so easy to put your coat on there. It's usually covered in a mound of jackets. But when we first moved in, we had little kids. Our youngest was just born after we moved into this house. And so we had little jackets and little snowsuits. And those little people couldn't reach the high hooks. And the high hooks were always full with their big siblings and their parents' stuff anyway. So when we first moved in, I added more hooks lower down. They've become invisible over the years as the jackets have gotten bigger and just tend to cover the whole thing. I told a story here recently about my friend who grew up in a conservative Christian family and faith community. And when he went away to university, he found many of his previously unquestioned beliefs called into question. And now, I don't think that's an unusual situation. Probably lots of us can identify with that experience one way or another. we grow up inside a community that one way or another is relatively insular or inward facing about its beliefs and their the particular theological perspectives or particular belief systems or even the language of belief is constantly reinforced and reinforced and reinforced from all these different perspectives, and other ways of looking at things or thinking about things are kind of elbowed away, or we're sort of protected from them as though they were something to fear. And so when we go away and we encounter different ways of thinking, it can be quite disconcerting. Now, this friend of mine, he's a very thoughtful guy. He's open-minded. He's very bright. He's inclined to explore. And this experience of hearing for the first time some substantial challenges to his belief system, which he would have, like many of us who grew up in those kind of circumstances, he would have just understood to be the truth, that experience of hearing those things be challenged kind of blew him out of the water. And he was having a bit of a, you know, faith crisis. And he was geographically far away from home, but a friend of his suggested he sit down with this kind of local wise person. And in the course of that conversation, this wise person said to my friend that our basic task in sorting through things like his crisis is to decide, in the words of this wise one, where we'll hang our hat and then live into that. This colloquialism that basically says, here's my place. Here's where I hang my hat. Now, maybe I'm just more connected to my folk saying collecting grandfather than I'm aware of, but that story and that phrase really stick with me. The longer I live, the more true that seems. It's not about some abstract idea like right belief. It's about choosing what you value above other things and then living into that. It's not static either. More on that later, but I was at an event last weekend where I saw a bunch of people that I know quite well but don't sit down and talk with all that often. One of them is a friend that I can pretty much just sort of go deep with in seconds. We're both a bit philosophical and we don't have what you might call conventional faith journeys or faith systems, whatever those might be, but for the two of us at least, it means that we both know that it's safe to just get right into it. We're not going to get judged. We're not going to get shunned. We're not going to get looked at like, you know, we have multiple eyes or something, extra eyes. So we, you know, we can just go for it. And this friend mentioned an idea to me. He credited this idea to the British philosopher John Stuart Mill. He wasn't confident about that attribution, but it was an idea that, as my friend said, wrecked him, but in a good way. And that idea, as he recalled it, was that if you don't know the arguments against what you believe, you really don't know what you believe. If you don't know the arguments against what you believe, then you really don't know what you believe. It's more like a rote thing. You can kind of spit back out what you say you believe, but you haven't really examined it. To put it into the more colloquial image that I've been using, if you haven't thought about where you want to hang your hat, you don't know why you're hanging it there. You're just coming in the door and tossing it where it's convenient. At that same party, I fell into an extended and quite engaged conversation about the deeply challenging world of personal pronouns. Now, it's a representative world, of course, but I told you this was an interesting group of people. In any case, I don't know how many of you have trans people or other non-gender conforming people in your life, but I do, and these folks do, and we all grew up with only two sets of pronouns for gender, the typical binary ones of sort of he and his and she and hers. And quite often, neither of those is accurate or safe or welcoming or even reasonably descriptive for a trans or gender non-conforming person. So if you want to interact with or speak with them in caring and true ways, you have to, this is one of the things that just has to be addressed. Now, as a culture, we're still in the pretty early going of the gender revolution. I just think we better just hold on because we're nowhere near done. But one of the ways that we can tell that it's early going is because the language is still so clunky. Right now, lots of trans folks have to resort to using they or them as a preferred pronoun. But I know from personal experience that not all of them like it. I imagine some do, but the people that I'm close to in that community generally don't like that. It's just that it's what we have to work with for now. he and she, his and hers, are not true to them. So they and theirs, or them, does a better job, but it kind of grinds. And you'd think it would be a pretty straightforward problem to solve, right? Just switch pronouns. How hard could it be? Great question. How hard could it be? Listen, if you think this is easy, first of all, I'd be willing to suggest that it probably means you haven't had to try to do it. But just in case, maybe you're the lucky one and it has been easy for you. But for most of us, I think if we think it's an easy problem to solve, it's a simple thing to test. You just do a simple kind of a thought experiment by just trying to get through two sentences about someone for whom you customarily and typically unconsciously use a binary pronoun, he or she, without doing so. Just try to get through two sentences about them without using those pronouns. For instance, if you're talking about someone that you know conforms to the conventional gender norms of a male, then try describing some activity that they are a part of without using any masculine pronouns. And I would suggest don't do this as a practice thing in their presence without their consent. That might be both unkind and disconcerting, but do try to find a space where you can do it out loud. Your car, but not the bus, for instance. Now, I suspect that unless you both think and speak with great deliberateness, I can almost guarantee you won't be able to do it. And in fact, unless you have someone helping you, you quite possibly won't even catch yourself when you blow it, at least not initially. This stuff is so ingrained for us. It's just wired into us from usually a lifetime for many of us of practicing doing this a certain way. It's a given. It's an example in the context of what I'm talking about this morning, of how often we hang our hat somewhere without giving it much thought. As one of the folks at this party said about the pronouns, you can't do that. Them and they are plural. Again, convention, right? Not in the final event, they're not, but you really have to think about it to realize that. So sometimes when it comes to seriously considering where we want to hang our I believe hats, it can be quite a challenging process. It can, as the friend of mine at this party said, it can wreck us, but in a good way, because it can produce this experience where it feels like our world just came untethered, like our hat just won't stay on the hook the way that it used to. And then what are we supposed to do? Well, I guess we have some options. Option one is that we don't do anything. We just keep tossing our hat in the same hook without thinking about why. It's easier, right? We can resort to habit rather than facing the challenge of really considering the why of what we say we believe or the problems that might go with it. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but I know I have. You find yourself in a religious setting where you had occasion to pray a group prayer or to recite a creed, and something inside of you just kind of makes this grinding, this dissonant signal that you were about to say, I believe, about something you either don't believe or that you've just never thought through. You don't know if you believe it, but you know you're supposed to, at least in that setting. Now, that exact moment where we experience that dissonance, that might not be exactly the best one to take a stand, but when we ignore those moments and we just carry on, we're not strengthening what we believe. We're actually entrenching our unconsidered commitment to something that we haven't really examined. We're just kind of auguring deeper into an unconsidered or unexamined belief. We're treating the world of belief as though it was a one-hook world in which everybody needs to hang their hats on the same thing. And I don't know about you, but I don't really want to live in that world. I don't think that works. So what might some other options be? Well, how about this one? We could start by considering the possibility that we might be living in a multi-hook world, if you're getting tired of this metaphor. It'll all be over soon, but a world that looks more like that pegboard that my dad made with the 50 pegs on it and less like the coat rack upstairs. three big arms on it. This is just another way of saying that there might be more than one sort of right hook that you can hang your hat on, and that our ability to see that reality emerges over time. I think this is the kind of idea that's hardest to entertain when our belief system is deeply established and surrounded by vigorous cultural reinforcement that just makes it hard to imagine another way. Especially if that reinforcement includes the possibility that stepping away from that one-hook world means we're stepping away from a lot of other things as well. We might be stepping away from being easily accepted into community, kind of feeling like we know what tribe we're a part of. We might be stepping away from the relative comfort of, yep, I know what you believe, you know what I believe, of operating with assumptions rather than constantly having to articulate these things or wrestle with them out loud. We might, for many of us, we might be stepping away from occupational things that are very comfortable. We might be stepping away from a network. If your career is in the religion business, then these kinds of considerations sometimes mean you're stepping away from your career, or you're putting your career in jeopardy, or you start to feel like you have to, you know, kind of be in hiding about what you believe or what you're wrestling with. All those kinds of things can go with that. So it's not an easy idea. There are probably lots of us who are familiar with that disconcertingly violent story in the Old Testament where Abraham believes that he's supposed to physically sacrifice his son Isaac to God. In our culture, in the 21st century West, we call that filicide, or we just call it, which is what we call it when a parent murders their child, but or we just call it plain old murder. And if the person's defense, if the murderer's defense was that God told them that to do it, then, you know, we call in the mental health experts. I mean, we hand them over to somebody else to help them reconsider the voice of God, if you will. But that's not the belief system that Abram is operating in, and those aren't the surrounding cultural values. If you take the time to read the story, there's no characters in it trailing along behind the father and son and their firewood-laden donkey as they head out pleading, don't do this awful thing. That voice is just not there in the story. Human sacrifice makes sense. Stay with me. Human sacrifice makes sense in a system where God is angry and needs to be placated by being given the most valuable things we have. And there's sort of this escalation of valuable things that you give to that sort of a deity. You start with your best crops or produce, and then you proceed to your best livestock, and then you move up the ladder to your kids. See, the character of Abraham in this story knows what he believes about God, and he knows what God is telling him to do. His understanding is that demonstrating his faith to God meant he needed to be willing to do anything he understood God to be asking him to do, and in a system of belief that says what you do for God is give God things to keep God happy, the pieces all fit together. And so those are the hooks that he hangs his hat on. Those are the beliefs that he's not only ready to die for, but he's ready to kill for. And then, of course, as the story unfolds at the very last moment, this messenger from God stops him and provides a ram, a male sheep that's stranded in a thicket for this blood sacrifice, and him and his son, go home together. Now, all sorts of traditions and all sorts of wise and learned folks have had a go at this story. I suspect I'm not going to add anything to that. The Jewish tradition is dominated by various rabbis' contention that the actual sacrifice of Isaac was never really a possibility in either the mind of God or the mind of Abraham, but was rather a sort of symbolic way of helping people understand that human sacrifice was off the table, so to speak. The Christian take is often that this is sort of a prefiguring of Jesus as the sacrifice, sacrificial lamb, and so on. I think it takes quite a lot of courage to speak that definitively about the mind of God. But one thing I really appreciate is all the different ways that this story has been understood, not only over the years, but across various traditions. What I want to suggest today is that whatever Abraham was thinking going into this experience, it's not what he's thinking coming out of it. His previous paradigm, the paradigm by which he is surrounded and which is so reinforced as the way things are, is if not shattered, then for sure shook up. Human sacrifice, Abraham, is not okay going forward. And you and your people need to learn to hang your hat on that. Now, we've still got a long story subsequent to that in which the characters seem to hold rather tightly to the ancient idea that death and blood spilled are required to make God happy, or at least to keep God from doing outrageous things. But even that story, I think, is slowly losing its grip, and there's a growing conversation about the place of human violence and all of those somebody has to die for this to be okay kinds of constructs. And this is, generally speaking, what happens over and over again in the history of people trying to figure out what they believe, what they're deep down committed to. We're doing the best that we can with what we have, with the language and the culture and the beliefs and the practices, and then the scene shifts, or we have an unprecedented experience or an encounter, maybe with a way of thinking that we've never run across before, and we look at where we so confidently hung our hat before, and we think, that won't do anymore. I can't hang my hat there anymore. But if part of our training has been that there's only one right hook or approved set of hooks, then we might experience a sort of dissonance that makes us feel like it's this hook or nothing. It's either sacrifice my son or be proven unfaithful to God, to put it into the Abraham and Isaac story. But wait, think about that story. There's a voice in there that we haven't heard before, that the characters haven't heard before, one that we might even call a messenger from God, saying, stop! I know you think this is the only way to believe and act out your faith, but if you take a minute and look just over there in that confusing thicket, you'll see that's not the case. There is another way. There's a pegboard full of hooks, not just a few, but many, made this way so you can choose where to hang your hat, so that faith doesn't need to be static, but can be dynamic, so that your systems of belief can evolve and grow, and your understanding and language can grow along with them. If you look at where you've hung your hat, and you find yourself thinking, I'm not done with sorting this out yet, at the very least, I think you can be confident that you're in good company. The book of Hebrews in the New Testament counts Abraham among the heroes of faith. And God knows he had to reconsider where he hung his hat. Peace.